I would also like to say that it's been a delight to be here this week. You folks have very adequately cared for us in offering your facilities to us and made us feel comfortable, and we appreciate that. And we'll have good memories of having been here. Now, the history topics that I've been doing, we looked at how the Dutch Mennonites moved from Holland, first of all, to Prussia, and then on to Russia. We pause to stop and look at what happened to the people who did not move on to Russia, who just stayed in Germany, and that terrible story. And then last evening, we looked at the story of what happened when the first migration came across from Russia to this area and to Canada. And now this evening, I would like to take the story from Canada to Mexico. But before I go there, I would like to raise a question that maybe you can help me with, because I don't know this. I do know that the first settlers came to this area from Russia in 1874. Now, one of my questions is, were the Amish people here when they got here?
No.
They were not.
10 years later.
10 years later. Okay. Another question. I know there was a Pennsylvania church here someplace of Mennonites, or my kind of people. What time did they get here?
Are you talking about the Sterling people, Sterling band of people?
I don't know if that's what you call them. They're the people that L.J. Heatwell was associating with. They called it the Pennsylvania Church. When George R. Brunk, Henry Brunk, came out here, there was...
Oh, that was New Amsterdam here somewhere. I think that was in McPherson County, or close to Kent.
Yeah, it could be. What year did they get here?
I cannot tell you. But let's help each other a little bit. Brunks, we have clues for Brunks, Heatwell,
okay, so you're saying that the Dutch-Russian people got here before either of the Amish or my kind of people got here. Interesting. Okay. Now, I remain ignorant about another thing, and I would really invite you to help me understand this. The question has been raised, what happened to these Dutch-Russian people when they got here? They came over here for matters of faith, but something happened to them here that they did not maintain what they had. And there was some kind of disconnect between Amish people and my kind of people, that there was never much of a coming together. It was always separate. Now, I wish somebody would instruct me about that. I do know this, that not long after they were here, other people approached them. I don't know if it was really they approaching others, but here's what happened. Among my people in Pennsylvania, we have what is called the General Conference Mennonites. And it was a break off of the Franconia Conference about 1846 with a man by the name of John Oberholzer. Okay. The motto of the General Conference was, in essentials, unity. In non-essentials, diversity. And in all things, charity. And these people who had just come from Russia are in a new area. So much had changed that the General Conference people somehow were able to reach them in this kind of a context and united with them. And may I say, I'm embarrassed to say this, I don't know if it's even the right thing to say, it seems that they spoiled them. Because this idea of in essentials unity, in non-essentials diversity, and in all things charity sounds pious, but it's very destructive when it gets worked out. There's a whole story there, and that's not my story tonight. Now here's the other thing. That's one side of thing. The other side is, when these people came through, like Cornelius Jansen, I've read his story. When he came through Canada, he could not connect with my kind of people there because the cultural differences and from what I read between the lines, the spiritual differences were too great. Something had happened to my people that they could not mesh with these people. One of the things that I love about Shepherd's Institute is we can come from all over the place, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Kansas, Pennsylvania, wherever, and we have different cultures. But somehow when we get here, that cultural thing kind of disappears. And we're able to actually blend our hearts and minds together in that room over there. And that's wonderful. And what I would like to understand is why more of that did not happen. One old timer told me that the cultural differences were too great between the Swiss German people who were here and those people that they were never able to come together in a productive way except for the Holdemans. And if I have enough time, I'll get to that story tonight. And so I've told you the problem, and I'm inviting you to preach to me after the service and help me understand more of this dynamic. Okay. So I don't get distracted later. This book I just referred to briefly is for the children, The Forsaken Child. Please let me read the back of it. How many of you have read this already? None of you. Well, let me read it to you. What do I hear? Marie sees a baby lying in the hog pen and scrambles over the fence to rescue it from a big sow. After taking it home, she prays, God, am I doing the right thing having someone else's newborn in my house? Maria's husband, John Dirksen, asks Sarah Harder to nurse the foundling. That evening, a meeting in the Russian Mennonite village decide that the Dirksens may raise the child. Though loved by his adoptive family, Johann faces ridicule and strange dangers in the village. When 7, he starts school, suffers under a cruel teacher, and then loses his mother, Marie. John and his second wife, Tina, care for Johann, but abandon him when they lack fare money to take him along to America. The Peters family adopts him, and Susanna becomes his mother. Pause. They don't say here that the biological mother tried several times to kill this boy. And one of the times, she didn't get it accomplished in the pig pen here. One other time, when this adoptive mother was out of the house, the biological mother ran into the house, grabbed the baby, took it to the barn, and put it right behind the horse's feet so the horse would step on it. And somehow the adoptive mother found it there before the horse stepped on it. And that's not the only time that this biological mother tried to do things. This is hard to imagine. When Johann crosses the Atlantic to settle, it's this third family that Johann crosses the Atlantic to settle in Manitoba. There he later is baptized as Johann Peters, buys his own farm, and marries Trentgen, however you pronounce that. But this little boy had a problem deciding what his last name was going to be because 3 mothers took care of him. And he doesn't know who his biological mother is. The painting below shows the happy pair moving things to their new home the day after their wedding. Johann often prays for God to protect him, and God does let him live for over 80 years and see his grandchildren. And there they are. And it is not the best well-written book, but it tells an unforgettable story. And if you talk to these people, they will know about this story. It's a story that's still alive among them. All right, now more directly to our story on how the old colony people migrated to Mexico. The old colony Mennonites did not exist as a separate people when they emigrated from Russia. That development happened in Manitoba in the West Reserve. Last night, we ended our time down here. Now we're going to have to just forsake Kansas a little bit and go up here. By the way, the story of the forsaken child, he first came to the East Reserve here, and then they moved over to the West Reserve. Okay, so the formation of the group of people called the Old Colony Mennonites happened in this West Reserve here. October 5, 1880 can be considered the date for the foundation formation of the old colony because on that date, Elder Johann Wiebe presided over a meeting which sorted out the people into two camps. Those who were willing to adhere to the old practices and beliefs renewed their commitments to the old ways, and those who were unwilling to conform to the old ways were encouraged to join the Bergthalers. Now, the Bergthalers were the people who came to the East Reserve. But there were some things desirable about the West Reserve. And so some of these people moved over from the East Reserve to the West Reserve. And so whenever this divided, the Bergthalers were there to take some of these people in. 10 years later, the old colony people possessed a strong sense of corporate identity. A Mennonite school association had formed in 1889, as well as a teacher training school set up by the Bergthalers. The old colony people were strongly opposed to both of them. They refused to compromise their strong sense of being a people of God who must keep the world out of their lives at all costs. For them, social isolation was the key to survival and growth. Formal education would be poison, which would destroy the old colony people. Now, let me just pause here at this point to share something with you that I've shared with the pastors over here earlier. Now, I know the old colony people were not really what you call old order people. They were old colony as a name because it referred to Cortiza. But they had some old order concepts. So when you have an old order concept, we have life issues. For example, let's just start with money and possessions and work and pleasure and friends and enemies and church and self and spouse and family. And the way you relate to these things has to do with your security and how you get guidance for life, what empowers you, the wisdom it gives you. But if you have the way it is done, then you have a way to relate to family, you have a way to relate to money, to possessions, to work, to pleasure, to friends, and so on. It is the way it's done. Well, the old colony people had a way that is to be done, even though they were not what we call old order. And the way it was done was supposed to be with the village system. That is the way you did things. Okay. What happens when you disturb this and you interfere with the way it's done? Okay, take a look. When there's nothing in the center, then how do you do things? Okay, coming from Russia to America put a big hole in there. And these old order people decided that the way to deal with this hole, the old colony said, we are going to have to reemphasize the way it is done, and we will do it this way. And if you don't do it this way, you're not with us anymore. Okay, the people who were not with him anymore faced this problem. Now, there's a huge problem with this. If you don't have the way it's done, you have to find something in the center that's going to give you guidance. Well, unfortunately, these people were not as tethered to the Word of God anymore. And it made huge problems. And I suspect, I'm not God, but I suspect that some of that same kind of thing happened to the Dutch-Russian Mennonites who even settled in this area. And that's what I want you to instruct me about. But this is a very serious issue. And the only way that this ever works to keep continuity of faith is if you have Jesus Christ in the center. And Jesus Christ gives principles, all kinds of principles for living. Principles for relating to family, principles relating to money, principles relating to possessions, principles related to work, principles related to pleasure or recreation, principles related to friends, principles how to relate to enemies, principles how to do church, even worship, like Linford was just telling us, principles how to relate to ourselves, principles how to relate to our spouses, and so on. And you never lose yourself as long as you're oriented and fixed and guided and anchored by Jesus Christ in the center. Extremely important. The fact that you folks are sitting here tonight indicates that you have had in your history something of this, or you wouldn't be here. This is extremely valuable. And this is the kind of concept you want to make sure you pass on to your children, the next generation, and the generation that comes. These people said that formal education would be a poison which would destroy the old colony people. Well, has formal education poisoned and destroyed you? The answer is no. I see you here. I sense kinship with you. And it's because you have had Jesus Christ as your center. The school issue was just one of several issues. One other contentious issue was a worship issue related to the singing of hymns. Some wanted to use hymn books with no written music, while others were ready to use poetry set to music. Now, can you worship with poetry with no music? How many of you think you can worship that way? The rest of you, if you don't raise your hand, you really believe that? That you cannot worship if you don't have music set to poetry, if you're going to sing. You can't sing just words. Well, this song that you have doesn't have an example of this, but some of you may remember the old church and Sunday school hymnal or the Mennonite hymnal. At some places, you could just go to a number and all there is words. And you just simply think of a tune that fits those words, or maybe they have some suggestion, and you can sing with no music there. Okay? Well, some of these people were ready to do that because they didn't want written music with their work, with their poems, and others wanted music, their poetry put in lines like we have in our hymn books now. Now, do you think that's something to divide over? Is that a moral issue? Well, these people did not have a principal center, and so it did. And there were two brothers, Johann and Gerhard Wiebe, who were central to this conflict. Another issue centered on the maintenance of the village system. The conservatives insisted that the village system brought with them from Russia must be retained in order to keep the sense of peoplehood. The Manitoba people, the native Manitoba people, used the Reeve system, which the Bergthalers adopted for two reasons. The Bergthalers were ready to abandon the village system, and many of their farmers lived on farms outside the village. So how's this supposed to work? And is this a moral issue, to live in a village versus not a village? Is that a moral issue? Lord Dufferin, Governor General of Canada, had promised the Mennonites complete freedom to operate their schools if they immigrated to Canada. Now, less than 20 years later, the story was changing. It took Russia 100 years to fall back on their promise. In Canada, it only took 20. English-speaking Canada wanted its citizens to speak English. Now, pause. In Russia, the reason that Russia wanted to get its people to all speak Russian is because they were switching from the concept of subjects to citizens. They wanted Russia to be like Western Europe, where there were such things as citizens. Okay, so these people come over here into Canada with a mindset, we're subjects. And we're promised by the king certain privileges, which we are guaranteed because we are, they think, subjects. But it turns out when they got here, they're not subjects. They become citizens. And so in Canada, in a citizen situation, everybody is supposed to participate in how you govern. It's called self-government. And in order to participate in self-government, you have to know the language of the area so you can make wise decisions about the issues that the local community faces. The Manitoba Public School Act of 1890 required that school instruction be in English and that schools conform to uniform educational standards. These people were not about to do that. However, in 1897, 7 years later, the law was amended to accommodate the French people who lived in Manitoba. The amended law permitted bilingual education as well as religious instruction in rural schools. The old colony people grabbed it, determined to use the law to their benefit. If the French can do it, we can do it. Thus, the old school system continued with school attendance for girls from age 7 to 13 and boys from 7 to 14 for 6 months of the year. The course of study included reading, writing, and arithmetic along with some religious instruction. And here I must confess my failure. Our friend, Mrs. Peters, is she here tonight? There she is. I forgot to bring this little book along that you gave me last night. But that is the little book. They have a catechism book that was their religious instruction. In 1909, the Manitoba Premier, Rodman Roblin, decided that the Mennonite schools would need to be upgraded with instruction in English. He's going to push the point here. And secondly, you folks are going to study Canadian history. And so the Bergthalers, they cooperated with this upgrade effort, but the old colony said, absolutely not. Then World War I came along. And World War I, for Canada, had Germany as the enemy. And these people spoke German. And World War I brought to Canada and the United States anti-German hysteria. Anything German was suspect. I think even sauerkraut was turned into victory cabbage and things like that. It was like anything German was, you're allergic to it. The School Attendance Act of 1916, which is during the war, made English the sole language of instruction and required all children to attend public schools unless private schools met the same educational standards. But the old colony said, absolutely not. The public schools set up in the area, staffed by Canadian teachers, received not a single old colony student. They would go to school, The teacher would come, raise the flag outside, sit inside, but no students came. The old colony people were not completely dumb, though. They smelled the rat. Premier Roblins was determined that all ethnic groups assimilate into the general Canadian culture. And that is one of the main reasons for having public schools. Anywhere, ever. You want all the students to melt into one common melting pot. And the way you do it is you teach them the same things, you give them the same values, and they mingle with each other, get past all their cultural differences, and so you can do something with them. We never thought this way, but in the United States here, years ago, it's been understood that the state owns the children. Did you know that the Wisconsin versus Yoder decision in 1972 was a landmark decision simply because it decided that parents own the children, not the state? That's a whole subject in itself. Can't go there tonight. But this is the concept behind public education. And these old colony people smelled that.
Brother Chester?
Yes. Yes. Yes, that is true.
So I just have memory of a time when public education was the parents getting together, electing local representatives to be a board, that board hiring teachers and so on. It's a whole lot different than to have a big unified district that are regulated by the state and funded by the federal money pot.
Yeah. Well, you folks out here in Kansas, I guess we're a little bit in the backwater. I never experienced that kind of thing. By the time I was in school, it was all this big consolidated effort. And I went to school with many people my grade, always. Never had more than one class in my classroom, ever. Grade one was a whole bunch of first graders. Grade two, a whole bunch of second graders, all the way up through. In 12th grade, there were 198 of us who graduated. But I don't dispute what you just said, because in the backwaters, that's the way it was. But I never experienced that. I'm sorry, did I? I'm sorry. Premier Roblins told the legislature, quote, "While we welcome all, our duty to British subjects is to see that the children are taught the principles of the British Constitution. What we need is to get the youth filled with the traditions of the British flag, and then when they are men, they will be able to defend it." And that's why the United States had me, when I was a little boy, standing in front of the United States flag every single morning saying, "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands. With one nation under God, with liberty and justice for all. And one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all." Yeah, you know it better than me. I wonder if you did. Well, I got a little older. I decided that wasn't a very wise thing to do. But anyway. During World War I, all the Mennonite groups were exempt from military service, but they were expected to purchase war bonds. The less conservative cooperated by supporting the Red Cross after they were assured that the Red Cross was not supporting the war effort. But the old colony refused to cooperate in any way. While all this tension between the Mennonites and the Canadian government was happening, the Canadian Mennonites were again running out of land. In the 10 years between 1895 and 1905, 1,000 old colony people moved northwestward to the Osler-Hague area of Saskatchewan. In 1905, another 900 moved to the Swift Current region of Saskatchewan. These migrations were primarily motivated by the need for more land, not the school trouble. Now, here is where those places are. Now, this is Lake Manitoba over here. And so where these people are moving from is back about over here. Okay? So here is the Osler Hague area, and down here is the Swift Current area. This is real far north of the U.S. border, and I don't know how far this is. This is the 52 parallel. This is 64. So they're all below 64. But when Canada forced the school issue, all the old colony people considered migration. These people, as well as these people over here. To search for new colonization sites, the old colony sent two men each from the three settlement areas in Manitoba and Saskatchewan, one from here, one from here, and one from the area over near Winnipeg. And they sent these scouts to South America. But those men found nothing. In the meantime, a delegation to Mexico returned with promising news. The old colony sent a new six-member team to further investigate Mexico. Now, I understand from Mrs. Peters that her grandpa, Heidi, what was his first name?
It's actually Isaac.
Okay, he was one of these people who investigated Mexico, right? They returned with a letter from A.I. Villarreal, Secretary of Lands and Commerce in Mexico, granting the Mennonites the freedoms they were requesting. So the old colony Mennonites responded by purchasing 230,000 acres of Mexican land in the state of Chihuahua for $8.25 an acre. This area later became known as Cuauhtémoc. And so let's see if we can get a map here. Now this map is kind of advanced of where we are in our story, but here is Swift Current, and here is the Hague-Osler community. And over here is Winnipeg. And when they went down, here's Chihuahua. And Cuauhtémoc is the city that, I guess you could say, these people basically built. Was there a little tiny town there to start with, Cuauhtémoc, to start with? Was it a Mexican village? A very small Mexican village. And they just moved in and took over the whole area. Okay, so here's the other place. Many people from Saskatchewan moved down here to Durango, which is further south in Mexico.
Jester,
yes.
My father just said that my mother went down there to that first settlement in VS, which I had from. I don't know if I knew, but
interesting.
That's why she was a single girl.
And what year was that? Okay, interesting. So you folks do have a connection there. Okay, the people from the Osler Hague area, Saskatchewan, that went to Durango purchased 35,000 acres of land there. Okay, then plans were made to emigrate. Each Oberschultz, Versteher, ordered the Schultz, or the mayor of each dorf or village, to arrange a meeting of villagers. Each head of the family, this is all up here in Canada now, each head of the family needed to declare whether he would move to Mexico or not. And if so, how much land would he like to purchase? Next, he would need to place the purchase money in the, Mrs. Peters, help me now to pronounce this, Wesenamt? How do you pronounce that word? A little louder? However that is, okay. Because of the favorable exchange rate and the difference in the land values, Most farmers were able to pay cash for their farms and still have some cash left over, some quite a bit. This is a good financial deal. In some cases, almost the entire village sold their real estate, packed their personal property, chased their livestock to the train. In most cases, some old colony people in each village did remain behind. And so on March 1, 1922, the first emigrants left Plum Coulee, Manitoba, arriving in Chihuahua, Mexico, 10 days later. In the following days, 6 trainloads of old colony Mennonites left Canada. And by the end of March, a total of 5,300 old colony people had arrived in Mexico into a desert. Immediately, they laid out new villages, usually naming them after the village they had just left in Canada. Approximately half of the old colony people of Manitoba and Saskatchewan ended up migrating to Mexico. All of the church leadership moved, as well as all of the Bush stayer. One old colonist described the result in Canada. There were about 32 farms in Cortiz, which is a particular village, before the migration. About 10 families remained. That means 22 farms were available for sale. Rosen, a Jew, bought up most of the farms at a very cheap price at about $15 to $25 an acre and resold them to other Mennonites who wanted this land and later to old colony people who were coming back from Mexico for about $75 to $100 an acre. This guy got rich fast. This profiteering contributed to bad feelings between the old colony members who left and those who stayed. The emigration created another problem in Canada. The church had stipulated that previously that no land in the villages could be sold to outsiders without the consent of the church ministers. With the emigration, the stipulation could not stand. Many other Mennonites and outsiders moved into the vacated farms and broke up the village system. And when the ministers moved, they took all the church records with them, along with other important documents. One person noted, the exodus of the Mennonites left that thing that she can pronounce in bad shape. In fact, they had intended to close the whole account down, leaving many accounts not settled. When the group left, they gave what was not settled to the local notary public in Morden, which is a town, and this notary public's name was Mr. Black. Now, he was to try to collect the bills and send the money to Mexico. Now, I'm going to ask you, do you think that happened? No. He tried to collect some debts, and this poor management created ill feelings that lingered for decades. Okay, so the ministers are gone, the leaders are gone, a lot of other people are gone, the records are gone. What are the people who stay supposed to do? Now think about the empty center that I'm talking to you about. With the old colony system broken down and no leadership, the remaining old colony people lost their morale. Probably some other things too. One person said, the old colony that left for Mexico consigned the ones remaining in Canada to the world. In other words, all the spiritual people, quote, moved to Mexico. And if you weren't spiritual enough, you just stayed there. And so you were in the world if you stayed here. All God's people went to Mexico. They are still hospitable and friendly, and we'll talk about everything but religion. When you talk to them about religion, they say, these are the old colony people, do you talk to us about religion? You're the ones that are lost. We ought to talk to you. So they will not talk religion to us. The Mennonites left Canada to stay pure and unmixed with the world. And what they predicted would happen has. Thus, that is, the old colonists that stayed here that are not Christian have gone modern. They use cars, dress like the world, go to school, and in general cannot be called a people anymore. The old colonists in Mexico have retained much of their original character. They did not want to keep pace with the world. They wanted to be separate. These here in Canada have gone to school and come back with frizzed hair. The Manitoba old colonists are not different from any other Mennonite group. They behave the same and are not better. End of quote. Instead of moving to extinction, the remaining old colonists regrouped and formed a new church. They were reluctant to join other groups of Mennonites. And within a few years, families and individuals who had moved to Mexico began to filter back to Canada. And the reason was, they moved into a desert, and it was very difficult for them to make any money farming in the desert. Finally, in 1936, the church back here chose three preachers and a deacon. But while all this is true, the Canadian and the Mexican old colony groups never lost contact with each other in spite of the hard feelings between them. Every single family who remained in Canada had relatives in Mexico. And thus, through the following years, Mexico and Canada have traded visitors, with some visitors to Canada deciding to stay. One estimate made in the 1960s claimed that 18% of each succeeding generation has returned to Canada. Another estimate claims that one half of all the old colonists now living in Manitoba or Saskatchewan are descendants of families who had lived at one time in Mexico. And so one big question remains. Was the emigration to Mexico necessary? Some say that emigration was absolutely essential to preserving the old colony faith. Any counter-argument evidences lack of faith. Others believe that eventually the old colony could have worked out some kind of agreement with the Canadian government if they would have been less arrogant. One Canadian person said, "The most tragic thing that happened to the old colony was the move to Mexico. They deteriorated so rapidly there that they quickly lost the very principles for which they left Canada. They could very quickly have found out that the things they held dear could be retained here much better than in Mexico. It was a sort of stubborn self-righteousness that sent them to Mexico. Before this, the old colony people were rich, prosperous, and progressive people. They lost almost everything financially and everything spiritually by moving. Now the old colony does not compare with the other Mennonite groups very favorably. They are less honest, though they are on the average no poorer than any other group." Okay. Now let me pause here. We could go on, say a few other things. Because I'm not talking at all about the Kleine Gemeinde. Maybe I shouldn't even enter that part. Let me just show some more things on the overheads here. As far as humans are concerned, ultimately the success of kingdom work hinges on the worker's integrity to Christ's governing principles and on their ability to apply those principles in any situation using their own moral compass. The problem was they didn't have something real and living in the center. That's why they couldn't make it. There's no problem with Christ, who is always consistent with his own principles. And so, folks, if we move into the future, we don't even know what our future is going to be. But if we have a living Christ in our hearts, and we are dedicated to his living word, and we apply it to any kind of situation, we can make it in any place we move to. But it requires that foundation. Now, I am somewhat ignorant, and Mrs. Peters ought to talk to us about this, or someone. But here's the original. E is the original East and West reserves. Here's the Swift Current. Here's Osler Hague. But eventually, they had other places also. And some of this was to get away, to be isolationist, which is a very unbiblical principle. That is not how we cope with problems, running away from them. But these people, as I would understand, tried to run away into the Fort St. John's area and the Fort Vermilion area. How many of you have ever read the book, The Brilliant Idiot? Okay? He also wrote a book called The Art of Listening. This man is an incredible man. But as I understand, he lived in either this colony or this colony originally. And the reason, now I'm not a scientist here, but one of the reasons you have people who are brilliant idiots is because these people never intermarried with anybody else. And so it's by selective breeding that you can become extremely intelligent. This man was so intelligent that he could do all kinds of things, but he could not tie his own shoes. And I know another man just like that. Here's some other places. This was the Rainy Lake area. And over here is Matheson. I don't know anything about this, but I do know something about this. This is the Almer area. Many of the people who lived in Mexico notice, went on from there to other places. Some of them went over to British Honduras or Belize. Some of them didn't go to South America. And by the way, when they went to South America, they went to Bolivia. And believe it or not, someone just told me recently, they are over 150,000 already in Bolivia. Do you have a more accurate number? Okay. Some of them returned. Some of them went over to Almer, Ontario as migrant workers. And now there's a flourishing colony of these people in Almer. I'm sure Mrs. Peters could give us much more than what I can on that. And so, here they are in Bolivia. And here they are in British Honduras or Belize. And here they are in various places in Mexico. This is, I think, called Tamaulipas over here. I think this is Durango. And these people are such incredible people. I've never seen anything like them. If they are so intelligent, they can almost make corn grow out of rocks. They're so industrious and ingenious. I just marvel what they can do. But one of the things that they have failed in is that their faith is not very intact. In fact, in Texas, or in some place in Mexico, some of the Swiss German people don't even want to be called Mennonites because of how wicked the Mennonites are. They are drug runners. They are drunks. And they are immoral. These people do not take their children to church. How old are you?
13.
Well, you could go to church. But children below 12 don't go to church. And on any Sunday morning, only a few people go to church. If all their members would come to a church, the church house would not be big enough to hold everybody. And if you do come to church, please, Mrs. Peters, if I'm saying this wrong, please correct me. But this is what I understand. I was never actually there. But if you come to church, you are supposed to sit with your head bowed forward like this. You may not look at the minister, because if you look at the minister, you're giving him an eye signal that you're challenging him. And so everybody has their heads down. Guess what happens whenever you put your heads down on a Sunday morning? And that's often what happens. Yeah, I'm just painting broad brush pictures. Okay. Okay, yes, 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 yes. Okay, well, the Kalinga Mindi, okay, this brings a real success story here. Some of these people have believed that ignorance is bliss. I've never encountered this kind of thing in my life. But they believe that the less you know, the less you're accountable for. And so many of these people are illiterate. Even their leaders are illiterate. Is that saying it too strongly? Okay, they have gotten so far to the end of the rope that they decided they need to do something. MCC was trying to help them with their educational things for years, but these people did not trust MCC. And finally, the MCC said, well, maybe we should use Old Order Amish to try to approach them. And the Old Order Amish began to relate to them, and it took 5 years for them to study these people and decide that they can work with Old Order Amish. And now a miracle is happening among those people. Old Order Amish have a mission to people in Mexico. They send their young people down to teach these people how to run schools. When I was in Ohio here just about 2 years ago in the summer, I knew that they were having a meeting. The Amish committee was having a meeting with its teachers. And I asked if I could attend this meeting because I had been in Mexico and had bumped into these people. And they said, well, we'll check. So they said, yes, you may come. But it'll all be in Pennsylvania Dutch. Okay. I at least want to go. I'm going to see what goes on at these places. And so I went, and they started in this meeting, and they had a big, if the committee sat across the front of the room, they had a big U down here with tables like this. And all the teachers who were at this meeting sat at these tables, and they started at the one end, and they wanted every teacher to stand up and talk about whatever. I think it was a third teacher stood up and looked straight at me and she said, do you know Pennsylvania Dutch? And I said, no. And so she started speaking English and every person after that spoke in English. I was so pleased because I got a chance to get in and see how this is done. Now the Amish people are not given to committees and fancy ways of doing things. And I got a chance to see how this works. And it is working in Mexico. These people are able to relate to these old colony people, and they are actually making a difference. And they have a publishing house at the Quellen Colony, which is, I guess, has roots with the Kleinige Mindy, called Central Scholar. And this publishing house is just mushrooming with providing materials both in German and in Spanish to these people. When I was there, they had just built a new section onto their publishing house for warehousing, all the stuff that they're doing. And so as we speak, there's a continuing miracle going on. And I think maybe you've had some people from your area go down and serve in these schools. Is that true?
I think it was in the Oasis.
Oh, so it's not under the Amish committee then?
No.
Ah, okay. I see. Okay, that means there must be more than one organization that's helping with these people, which is very good.
Susanna says that they do interact with the Amish teachers that are down there, so
yes. Yes. Do you have anything you want to say further about that, Mrs. Peters? Okay. Our time is up. I think we'll just stop with that. Thank you very much for your attention. And, yes?
I do have one question, if I may.
Sure.
Where did the Mennonite brethren come in the whole in Russia? Where did that division come from?
Okay. Back in 1814, not long after the Malachna colony started, there was some spiritual problems, and a man by the name of Klaus Reimer organized a spiritual renewal movement, and that was where the Kleinige Mindy began. It was only a small group of people, and it was always called Kleinige Mindy, which means little church. Okay, in 1860, the spiritual quality of the Russian Mennonites was not good, and that's saying it mildly, okay, especially with drunkenness. And there was a man by the name of Edward Wust, who was a German pietist, who came in and started preaching among these people, and there was a spiritual revival at that time. Okay, when this spiritual revival took place, the old Russian, what they call it, the Kirch? How do you? Kirchen, whatever that is. Okay. The main church and this new Mennonite Brethren thing, it was a whole lot bigger than Kleine Gemeinde. It was not even associated with the Kleine Gemeinde, but it challenged these people with their sinfulness. And there was strict animosity. There was fighting between these groups. Beatings. People would beat each other. But eventually, it was so big that these people, in their improved piety, in improved behavior, and improved spiritual life, actually rubbed off on some of these people, and these people actually improved. And the Mennonite Brethren have emigrated to the United States as well with some of the later migrations. Mrs. Peters, do you know whether any of them came over with the first migration in 1874? Okay, well, they're over here alive and well, especially in California. I have a son by the name of Wesley who lives at Squaw Valley, which is in the backyard of their Fresno Pacific University. That is the Mennonite Brethren College.
Oh.
Is another one.
There are Mennonite Brethren here, like in Bueller, there's a Mennonite Brethren church, and I don't know where all, but Hillsboro and Bueller for sure.
David?
Well, the reason for raising the question is that we travel to India some, well, when I do, and in Hyderabad is sort of the center of the Mennonite Brethren community. There are, and those missionaries came down from Russia.
Wow.
In the
interesting. Somebody else had a hand back there. Yes, Paul.
And also the emigration from Russia back into Germany, like in around 90 when the Iron Curtain fell, those are fairly conservative now, rather yet.
So it's an ongoing story. One of the things that has distinguished Mennonite Brethren from the others is that they adopted more of an evangelical theology as they went through the years. And for a while, they had an Anabaptist evangelical connection, but they were heading more evangelical. But in more recent years, there's been kind of a return to more of an Anabaptist theology. So, anything else? Yes. Oh, yes. And that was a key point. They wanted immersion, baptism. And that was really offensive to the mainliners. Okay. Anything else? Okay. If not, I guess we can talk afterwards. But I really would someone to fill me in on some of the things I talked about at the beginning. Okay. Dwight, I'm going to just turn it over to you to close, however you want to do it. If you want to sing a song, or if you want to lead us in prayer or whatever, you...